The final chapter for the unit, which is what we're starting now, is all about the specialness of carbon. And we just finished a chapter that was all about the specialness of water, which can't have life without water. Well, you can't have life without carbon either. Life is often defined, we often use the phrase carbon-based life because of how important carbon is. Well, this brings up kind of a tricky definition to start the chapter, which is organic. It's tricky for several reasons. One is that it's used in science and it's used outside of science. So organic, as far as the grocery store is concerned, is a totally different meaning. All food is organic, chemically speaking, whether the grocery store calls it organic or not. That has to do with how it's grown. It's a totally different definition. That's not what I'm talking about here. But the word organic scientifically comes from a mistake we made for a long time in science history. For a long time, for most of the time, we mistakenly believed that the things that organisms are made out of, living things, is fundamentally different stuff compared to the things that non-living things are made out of. And therefore, this is still what we thought is actually wrong. We believed that it wasn't possible to start with stuff that a non-living thing is made out of and turn it in chemically into stuff that living things are made out of. Now, that's wrong. It's easy to do that, actually. We just didn't succeed in doing it for most of our history. So we gave the name organic to the stuff that organisms are made out of. That's what the organ part of that word refers to. Organic material comes from organisms. Well, it doesn't have to, is what we learned. But we still use this kind of old-fashioned term. It just has a new definition. And the new definition includes the requirement of containing carbon. Now, I say it that way because organic doesn't simply mean carbon-containing. Containing carbon is a necessity for something to be organic. But even though it's necessary, it's not sufficient. It goes beyond just containing carbon. A good example of that, since you're writing notes, and most of you are probably using pencil to do that, is that what we mistakenly call lead, there really aren't any true lead pencils anymore. You use graphite. What you call pencil lead is really graphite, which is pure carbon. It's nothing but carbon atoms. And so obviously it's carbon-containing, right? Pure carbon is carbon-containing. But pure carbon is not organic. So yes, it's true that organic things have to have carbon in them, but that's not enough. To be organic, you have to contain carbon plus other stuff. Maybe the only other stuff besides carbon is hydrogen. That's enough to make it organic. But pure carbon, another example of pure carbon is diamond. It's exactly carbon also. It's just the atoms are connected together separately and the price is a little different. But it's still pure carbon. So diamond is not organic either. Well, diamond and graphite are both elements, right? Because there's nothing but carbon there. No element is organic. Organic things have to be compounds because you have to have carbon and you have to have something else. Now, we also, it's kind of a tricky too because there we've made some exceptions in the definition. So it's, for instance, carbon dioxide by what I've just told you, would qualify as organic, right? But it's not. Carbon dioxide has carbon, plus it has something else, oxygen, but we still don't consider that to be organic. We've made an exception of that to that for historic reasons, and there's just a couple other compounds that we're not going to discuss in this course that are also exceptions. For this course, just keep in mind, because we're going to talk about this later in different units, carbon dioxide is not considered organic. But nearly all other carbon compounds, meaning carbon with something else, are organic. And that's what makes them organic. Not that they came from something that's living or dead, simply that they have carbon and other things in them. Now, chemistry is an immensely huge science. And you can roughly cut it into two big pieces that are themselves huge sciences based on this definition. So there is inorganic chemistry, which is not concerned with carbon-containing compounds, and organic chemistry. Those are big sciences each. And then a branch, really, of organic chemistry is the chemistry of biology. Biochemistry is part of organic chemistry. Okay, now, with all that definition in mind, let's recall what I've already talked about as far as cell theory is concerned. Cell theory tells us what?
All cells are derived from a different cell.
Right. Cells come only from pre-existing cells. They don't just pop into existence. Well, that's been true for a long time, but obviously it can't have always been true. There had to have been some first cells that did come into existence from things that weren't cells before them. And that brings up the question then of how did that happen? To be a cell, which defines all organisms, right? Every organism has to have at least one cell to be an organism. To have a cell and therefore be alive, you have to be made of the things that cells are made of. And the things that cells are made of are largely organic compounds, carbon-containing compounds. And organic compounds really didn't exist in early Earth. There were simple compounds, there was carbon, but there weren't organic compounds. And so the apparatus in cartoon form here in this opening slide is the setup of a famous set of experiments conducted in the 50s, the so-called Miller-Urey experiment. You don't have to remember the names, but that's what it's called. To test whether organic compounds could be produced from inorganic compounds given the conditions that we're pretty sure Earth had before there was any life. And to put this in perspective, there's almost a billion years, almost the first billion years of Earth's history, there was no life. So life didn't just pop into existence as soon as there was a planet. There was, you know, a billion years is a very long time. I don't have to tell you that. Ever since then, there's been life. But this is the early history I'm talking about, before there were any cells. So they set this up to mimic the early Earth conditions, which were much, much hotter than they are now, which is why that early eon is called the Hadean, meaning hell-like, very hot. And that's why they have this ocean, that this bulb represents the ocean. Remember, that's where life started. That's why they have fire under it. It's very hot. And in there, it's not just pure water. In there is the things that we know early Earth must have contained. And they let this run, basically. They just let time pass. This is evaporating to create an atmosphere. That's this other bulb. And in the atmospheric bulb, notice they have two electrodes that they can, every once in a while, hit a switch and cause a spark to represent lightning that was occurring for these hundreds of millions of years before life existed. So there's plenty of time for the real thing to work. This experiment, though, they only needed to run this for a number of weeks, sampling it now and then, before they saw that in these samples they were accumulating organic material out of inorganic material. And so the things that cells are made out of, like the amino acids that make up proteins and so on, those things actually came into existence in this experiment. And they redid this more carefully in the 2000s or 2010s, some more recently. And it did an even better job. They made even more amino acids than life requires. So that's just one way in which the building blocks to make the first cells could have come into existence. Doesn't mean it's the only way, even though they've demonstrated it can happen this way. That could just be one way. You could also have, at the same time, organic material that's already formed coming in from outer space. You know, asteroids hitting the Earth or whatever could bring organic material too. And they might both be true. Anyway, let's go on to the next slide and for the rest of the chapter talk about carbon-containing compounds. This table just shows you some examples of organic compounds. Now, these are all organic because in addition to carbon, they have something else. In this case, in all of these examples, that something else besides carbon is hydrogen only. Every one of these three examples has only carbon and hydrogen in them. That's enough to qualify them as organic. But organic materials might have other things besides carbon and hydrogen. Well, an important subset of organic compounds are the ones that are made of only carbon and hydrogen, which are therefore named hydrocarbons. A hydrocarbon has nothing but carbon and hydrogen in it. And I just almost made the mistake of confusing that word with the related word carbohydrate. We'll talk about carbohydrates later. Carbohydrates have carbon and hydrogen also, but they have oxygen as well. A hydrocarbon does not. Only carbon and hydrogen. And you can see that when the structural formula, is the ones that you see here with the symbols for the atoms involved. They're flat. The real molecule is not flattened into two dimensions. This just shows you the connections between individual atoms. That's why it's useful. The ball and stick models are three-dimensional, and they show you the geometry of the molecules. And by the way, why does it make sense to call these molecules when you're talking about organic compounds? What makes them molecules? Exactly. Structures that have bonds that are covalent are molecules. Structures that have bonds that are ionic are salts, not molecules. And what types of atoms form covalent bonds? Anyone? Well, what types of atoms make ionic bonds? Well, they become charged. But in order for that to happen, you have to have what kind of atoms? They become ions. Before they actually ionize, what do the two atoms need to be? One of what and one of what? A metal and a non-metal. Yeah, that forms salts, ionic compounds. What kind of atoms bond to form molecules?
Two non-metals.
Non-metals, right. It can be two of the same or two different non-metals. So we're talking about that relatively small subset of elements that are the non-metals, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, those ones in the upper right triangle. And that's true for all of these. So these are just some examples of hydrocarbons, which is an important subset of organic compounds. In slide 3, we can see valences being depicted here. Now, why does hydrogen have a valence of 1? What does the word valence, when it's used by itself, mean? What's the definition of valence? Okay, you are going to definitely need to study this stuff every night as we continue. Correct. How many additional electrons would have to be taken on by that atom to fill its outer shell, its valence shell, in other words? So why is the valence for hydrogen 1? Right. The valence shell for hydrogen is the only shell that it has any electrons in, right? Which is shell 1. Total of 1 orbital, and therefore the entire shell can hold only 2, up to 2. It already has 1, therefore it can take on 1 more. That's why its valence is 1. Well, oxygen has a valence of 6, 8 overall electrons, but we don't care about those inner electrons. Those are shielded by the valence shell. The valence shell has 6, the other 6 of the 8 total. But the outer shell can hold up to 8 because there are 4 orbitals in that shell. And therefore, oxygen has a valence of 2 because you need to add 2 more to satisfy the valence. To fill that valence shell, I mean. This is why oxygen always, if it's a member of a molecule, will always be making 2 total bonds. Hydrogen will always be making 1 total bond in any molecule it's part of. Nitrogen has a valence of 3 because it has 5 valence electrons. It's 3 away from being filled. On the periodic table, it's 3 steps from the right edge. But carbon, notice, which is just to the left of nitrogen, and therefore 4 steps away from the right edge, has a valence of 4. It's halfway filled, halfway empty. And it doesn't have any unpaired electrons. When you draw an electron dot diagram, you start with using the symbol for the atom, the chemical symbol for the atom, to represent the nucleus, right? So for carbon, that's C. Well, let's do oxygen. You start with O to tell you that's an oxygen nucleus. You don't, in any electron dot diagram, you don't put any non-valence electrons. Those are there. We're just not depicting them. The only ones you write dots for are the valence electrons. And for oxygen, the valence shell is shell 2, correct? How many total orbitals?
4
orbitals, 3 different P's, and also an S in that second shell. So think of the 4 orbitals as the 4 directions away from this oxygen center. All right. Now you have to think of how many valence electrons there are. Oxygen has 6 valence electrons, right? 6 in that valence shell. Well, you put dots down one at a time, but you put each dot in its own orbital until you run out of orbitals. So that's why you start with 4 dots. You still have 2 more electrons, though, to fill. So then you start pairing them up until you run out of orbitals. I mean, until you run out of electrons. So this shows you that oxygen has 2 pairs of electrons. Each of those pairs fills up an orbital, and those are not going to be involved in sharing. Those ones are satisfied where they are. These 2, though, are unpaired, and so they're not going to be stable until another electron is added to that orbital from another atom that oxygen is sharing with. This is why the valence is 2, which is another way of saying oxygen is going to form 2 bonds overall. It can be 2 single bonds or a double bond. They both add up to 2. And nitrogen has 3 that it needs to take care of, so it's going to form 3 bonds. Well, carbon doesn't have any pairs that are going to stay with nitrogen. They're all going to be involved in sharing. And so the valence is 4. We can say that in one word by saying that carbon is tetravalent, or it has tetravalence. Tetra simply means 4, right? like in tetrahedron. And that makes it special compared to these other three nonmetals we're looking at. Because it gives carbon greater variety when it comes to making bonds with other things. And other things can include other carbons, by the way. Hydrogen doesn't have much variety. It has to make one bond. That's the only possibility. But it does have a little bit of variety because it can make that bond with any other kind of atom. So what specific kind of atom it makes is its only source of variety. Carbon has a lot more variety, though, because it has to make four bonds. Well, in addition to making those four bonds with a variety of different atoms, it also has variety with respect to the bonds. It can add up to four by making four individual single bonds. It can make two double bonds. It's another way. Or it can make a triple bond and a single bond. Any of those scenarios adds up to four. So there's variety just with respect to the bonding. And then for each of those possibilities, there's more variety based on what kind of atom is actually bonded to it. So carbon can be used in a lot of different ways to make a lot of different compounds. In the periodic table, what did we say the columns are called? Periods are the rows, groups. And what is true about the members of any given group? Why do they occur in the same group? Right, they have similar chemical properties, including valence. That's why I keep talking about how many steps from the right edge. So carbon is tetravalent, four steps from the edge. It has a valence of four, but it's not the only thing that has a valence of four, right? Because there's other things in that group with the same valence. Well, if I ask you to consider just that group that carbon's a member of, just that column, what is special about carbon compared to the other ones in that same group? That's true, yes, that is one special thing about it, but even more basic, you know, if I were asking a little kid, he probably wouldn't say, it's a non-metal, because he hadn't learned that yet. Another special thing about it, though, that a kid might notice is that it's at the top. It's the smallest, in other words, because the periodic table is ordered by size of the atom. So it's the smallest of the tetravalent atoms in the universe. And therefore, it's the most common tetravalent atom in the universe. And because of this great variety, that's why it became the molecule of life, so to speak. Because you can make a great variety of organic compounds because of that tetravalence. And that's what organisms are made out of. Yes, there are some inorganic molecules in organisms. Water is a good one, right? We can't live without water, and water's not organic. There's no carbon in it. But the big molecules, comparatively big molecules, that really define organisms are all organic. And we're going to devote a chapter to those after this first upcoming test. We're going to one by one survey the major categories of biological macromolecules. There are four categories. Each one of those is not only a macromolecule, it's an organic macromolecule. They're all carbon-based. Slide four is a structural formula showing urea. Urea is an organic compound, and it's a waste product that is produced as a byproduct of using amino acids that come from protein as fuel. So your liver produces this. It's toxic, so we don't let it build up. We send it to the kidneys, and the kidneys get rid of it as part of urine. That's what it does in your body, but that's not why it's shown in this slide. The reason it's shown in this slide is for historical reasons. I told you that we believed mistakenly for a long time that you couldn't you couldn't transform inorganic stuff into organic stuff. Well, we can easily nowadays, but it was a challenge for a long time. That's why we believed it was impossible. That's why we called things that are from living things organic. Urea, though, is historically important because it is the first successfully produced organic compound from inorganic material. In other words, it was just made in a lab. It wasn't gotten from an organic, gotten from a living thing. Now it's pretty easy to do that. Slide 5 gives you more examples of not only organic compounds, but notice each one of these is more specifically a hydrocarbon, because each of these contains nothing but carbon and hydrogen. And they are really important for a lot of reasons. Hydrocarbons in general store a lot of chemical energy, and that makes them excellent fuels. For instance, unfortunately, we're still using mostly automobiles that have internal combustion engines, so they burn gasoline. Gasoline is really just a mixture of a bunch of different hydrocarbons. Like you'll see an octane rating on the pump. Octane is just one of several different hydrocarbons that together make up gasoline. But it's because of these carbon-hydrogen bonds that they're so good fuel sources, and I'll explain that more in a different unit. Hydrocarbons are limitless, though, in terms of how many can be produced, how many different kinds can be produced. You see just a tiny sampling here. And so to keep track of all these, we classify them in different ways, put them into groups based on different criteria. One of those criteria is length, and length here refers to the part that is highlighted in cyan in each of these. That's called the carbon skeleton. So hydrocarbon, by definition, has carbon and hydrogen, but however many carbons it has are connected to each other in what is called the carbon skeleton, and then all the hydrogens are connected to that skeleton. All right? So one way you can classify hydrocarbons is simply by how many carbons are in the skeleton. Ethane and propane are both examples of hydrocarbons that are called alkanes. Notice that alkane itself ends in A-N-E. Alkane is not a single substance, it's a category. But individual alkanes get names that end in A-N-E to remind you that they are alkanes. An alkane is a hydrocarbon with only single bonds in it. As you can see here, these are only single bonds. And so what comes before the A-N-E, tells you how many carbons there are. Eth means 2, prop means 3, bute means 4, butane has 4 carbons, and so on. Octane has 8. That's one way, just the length of the carbon skeleton. In B, we can see that you can also classify them. This is a totally different criterion. We can classify them based on whether or not the carbon skeleton has branches in it. Now, you can't have any branching with only 2 or 3, but as soon as you get 4 or more, it's possible to have branches. Like the unbranched one here is butane. Methylpropane also has 4, but it's instead of being 4 in a line, it's forming a T, a branch. And the more carbons you have, the more branches that are possible, which is why there are so many possible hydrocarbons. Double bonds is shown in C. This is another way we can classify them. I said that alkanes are hydrocarbons that have only single bonds. Well, if you have a hydrocarbon that has at least one, maybe more, but at least one double bond, then it's not an alkane anymore. It's an alkene, which ends in E-N-E. And butene, 1-butene and 2-butene are very similar, but the difference is where that double bond is located, in the first position or in the second position, 1-butene versus 2-butene. And there's also a category called alkynes with a Y. So there are alkanes, alkenes, and alkynes. And those names end in Y-N-E. An alkyne has to have at least one triple bond in it. So they're rarer, but they exist. And then finally, in D, we can see that we can classify hydrocarbons based on whether or not the carbon skeleton has rings, a ring structure. A ring means that the skeleton wraps back and connects to itself. And you can have one ring or more, or none. Cyclohexane and benzene are famous examples of, or common examples of ring structures. Every one of these pairs, or no, I'm sorry, in branching, for B, C, and D, each of the pairs has exactly the same number of carbons and exactly the same number of hydrogens compared to the other one. That means that these two, butane, for instance, and 2-methylpropane, have exactly the same chemical formula. In this case, they are both C4H10. And that's why, just looking at the chemical formula by itself, you can't tell which one it's referring to, even though these are different chemicals. Two different chemicals that have exactly the same chemical formula are called isomers. Iso means same, so it's referring to the same chemical formula. They're different substances, though, because the way those atoms that make up the substance are put together is different in the two. One butene and two butene are also isomers of each other. They have exactly the same chemical formula. So we'll get back to this isomer notion in a minute, but first let's go to 6. What we're looking at here in cartoon form on the right is a fat. And I'll have much more to say about fats in a different chapter. But fats can also be called triglycerides. It's really a four-part molecule. You have this part where all these three tails are coming together. That by itself would be called a glycerol. And then you attach to that glycerol three fatty acids, which are these tails, to make the overall fat. Well, a little bit ago today, I told you that hydrocarbons in general make excellent fuels because of all those CH bonds. There's a lot of chemical energy locked in there that can be tapped. If you break the bonds, you release the energy. That's what we do when we burn fuels. Well, that's true for not only gasoline or burning wood or whatever. It's also true within cells. Cells use fuels to give you the energy to do the things that life requires. And an important source of fuel for cells are the fatty acids that come from fat. If you look at these cartoon versions, you'll see that each tail, if you just consider the tail by itself, not the part where it's connected, it's nothing but carbons and hydrogens, right? So these fatty acid tails are hydrocarbon tails. And just like gasoline is good fuel because it's a hydrocarbon, so are fatty acids. Stores a lot of energy. This, by the way, is why no matter what form the food comes in as, it doesn't have to be fat that we take in. If we take in more than we need based on our activity level, then that extra energy, instead of burning it, we store for later, but we don't store it as what it comes in as. We dismantle the food molecule and then produce fats out of it. We store it as fat because then we can store it more efficiently. There's a lot of energy in a small space. If we stored our energy as protein or as carbohydrate, we would have to be bigger to contain that same amount of energy. We would therefore be heavier. All right, 7. This is more about isomers. Now, there are more than three categories of isomers in organic chemistry, but for this course, you only have to know these three categories. And as you see, the categories are structural isomers, geometric isomers, and enantiomers. Now, the easiest to understand, or the top structural isomers are... First of all, they're isomers, which means they have exactly the same chemical formula, same number of and types of atoms. But structural isomers are defined as structural because the difference between them is just in the shape of the carbon skeleton. Pentane is not branched. 2-methylbutane is. Therefore, they are structural isomers. Notice that both of those compounds have only single bonds. They're alkanes. Later today, when you play with the ball and stick models to make your own molecules, you'll notice that a single bond, which is represented by a stick in the model, and the balls are the atoms that are connected together, if you have just a single bond, it's possible to twist the atoms. They swivel with respect to each other. But if you have a double bond, then you can't swivel them. It locks them in place. So when you have a double bond involved, then you can have the possibility of what are called geometric isomers. Now, X here can represent anything other than hydrogen. X is not on the periodic table, so it's not a specific thing. It's just something other than hydrogen. You have hydrogens here, you have something else here connected to the carbons. And a double bond between the carbons, and therefore you couldn't spin this. So there's two possibilities. Those X's can be locked on the same side, like they are here, or they can be locked so that they're on opposite sides. And that's two different chemicals, even though they're almost identical. They're isomers that are called geometric isomers. And the two versions get their own name designation, which is cis and trans. Same prefixes that we use for genders nowadays. Cisgender, transgender. Cis means same side, trans means across or other side. Then we have the third category on the bottom, which are the enantiomers. And you have this possibility when you have a carbon, which remember, carbon is tetravalent, so it has to have four bonds. In the specific case that a carbon is forming its four bonds as four single bonds, plus those four single bonds are made with four different things. So if these were all hydrogens, there would only be one way you could do this. But if they're all four different from each other, then you have two possibilities here. And you produced what is called a chiral compound. It has chirality. Chiral means handed. Chirality means handedness, meaning that there is a left-handed version and a right-handed version. By analogy with your real hands, that's why hands are shown here along with them. If you consider your hands, for most people, the left hand and the right hand are very, very similar. But they're not the same, right? They're mirror images of each other. If you were able to remove your hands and play around with them and move them around in space, there's no way that you could take your right hand and move it in such a way and put it back down on the table so that it would be your left hand. They are different from each other permanently, mirror images of each other. And similarly, if you have this molecule with carbon in the middle and four different things at the four corners, there's no way you could pick that model up, move it around, and put it back down so that it becomes this version. The only way you could do that is to break two bonds and switch the two atoms on the corners. That's a different thing, permanently different. Okay, so there's a left-hand version and a right-hand version for enantiomers. And that matters biologically. Slide 8 shows you some drugs. Drugs are signals like we talked about before, right? And remember that signals don't have any effect in any cell unless they bind to a receptor. That's the only way the cell is going to know the signal's even there. Well, just like a right hand does not fit well into a left glove, a right-handed receptor is only going to fit well a right-handed signal. It won't fit the left-handed signal. Okay? So you can see here that there's two versions of each of these two drugs. There's two versions of ibuprofen, S and R, left-handed and right-handed, but only one of them will work in the body because the body has only one kind of receptor. In this case, it has the left-handed receptor, and therefore the S version, which is the left-handed version, works. The right-handed doesn't. But it's not always that way. It's on a signal-by-signal basis. For albuterol, a different drug, the left-handed version is worthless. You can put it into the body, but the body won't know it's there. The right-handed version is the version that works. So enantiomers have handedness, and handedness matters, chemically speaking, as far as how it interacts with other things. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, and I usually, that's where I'm going right now, but we're out of time, so I'll start there next time.
This why oftentimes have like multiple steps, like chemical process, because you have like the first step, so you get like a certain shape to prevent that?
Yes, that's part of the intricate process of producing drugs, which is why it's so expensive. But I'm not sure how. I don't know specifically chemically how they make sure that it's going to be right-handed or only.
And what the first step it's going to be.
It's an important thing from their point of view, though, because if they make any of the wrong stuff, it's just a total waste of money from their point of view. So either they make them both because they have to, and then they get rid of one somehow. I'm not sure. That's a good question.